Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13, chapters 13 really through 23, have prophecies that are what sometimes is translated the burden, 13 verse 1. They have these prophecies that are called the burden, and they're about various nations. All right, whereas chapters 2 through 12 of Isaiah were primarily aimed at Israel and Judah, especially at the inhabitants of Jerusalem. These other ones, we still have to remember that Judah is the one who's supposed to hear these prophecies. It's not as if Isaiah is speaking to, for example, Babylon in chapter 13, but he's speaking to Babylon for Judah to hear. In other words, this is a warning to Babylon for the people, God's people, to hear it. They're to learn something from that. That means there's something for us to learn. But what we find out is that each one of these sections begins with a reference to this burden or an oracle, some kind of a prophecy. The word burden here has the idea of being, well, there's actually three ways we could take it. We could take it as this is a really hard prophecy to deliver, so it's a burden for the prophet to carry it. We could take it as a burden for those who are about to receive it. In other words, the prophecy is so severe that it's hard for them to receive the prophecy. Or, and this is the one I prefer, is the word for burden here comes from the word that means to carry something or to lift something up. And I think it more has the idea of lifting up the voice. In other words, Isaiah's been called on to lift up his voice and declare this. All right. So the idea here is the declaration or the, if you, burden doesn't fit in that kind of an interpretation of it, but the idea of the what God called Isaiah to lift up his voice regarding Babylon. Okay. But it could mean any of those. We're not exactly sure how in the context that Hebrew word's being used. But nonetheless, we know it's a message from God to these nations. Now, we find that there are actually 10 of these various prophecies throughout these passages. So, for example, chapters 13 and 14 form one of them. Starting in chapter 15, you see the burden of Moab. Right? That's chapter 15. Chapter 14, verse 28, you see, he says, in the year that King Uzziah died, was this burden? And we see one for Palestina, which is Philistia. Chapter 17, the burden of Damascus. And then we also see Israel mentioned in there. Chapter 19, the burden of Egypt. Chapter 21, the burden of the desert of the sea. All right. And that, again, that is a prophecy about Babylon as you go through it. Chapter 22, the burden of the valley of vision. And here we see Edom in the prophecy. Chapter 22, verse 13 says, "And behold, with joy and gladness, slaying oxen and killing sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die." Chapter 22, verses 13 through 17, we see a prophecy there. Verse 15, "Thus says the Lord God of hosts, go get the end of this treasure, even unto Shibna, which is over this house," etc. We see a reference to Arabia. Chapters 22 also makes reference of Jerusalem. Chapter 23 makes reference to the burden of Tyre. And so what we see in this is they actually form these 10 prophecies, the different kingdoms that are mentioned, form two sets, and they both begin with a prophecy about Babylon and God's judgment on Babylon. Then they move to God's making a reference to kingdoms who are going to have refugees who are fleeing because of the judgment of God coming on them. Then they move to a warning for God's people. So, for example, in chapter 17 and then in chapter 22, we have a message for Israel and for Jerusalem to warn God's people. And then in chapter 19 and then in chapter 23, which become parallel to each other, we have prophecies about Egypt and Tyre. And so there is sort of an arrangement here where he's arranging the order of these prophecies. They were all probably given in a particular time period, but they were arranged by Isaiah in this book. In other words, they may not be in chronological order, but they're in an order in such a way that it draws attention to the fact that God wants his people to get the message. In other words, he starts with Babylon, and in the midst of the prophecies, he draws attention to his own people, Jerusalem and Israel. And he says, listen, here's what you need to learn. Here's how you need to trust God. And so he starts with this prophecy of Babylon in chapter 13. And as we go through these, I'll try not to get bogged down in too much detail of exactly what's going on in regard to each one of these nations, because it can get kind of complicated, but we'll try to get the big picture and explain the details as we go through them. But ultimately, what we are going to see is God is going to be asking Isaiah, who are you trusting? In other words, there's judgment coming. Who are you trusting? All right, who's your trust in? We see later on in the book of Isaiah, one of the things that he condemns is their worship of idols. So we know at times they're worshiping idols. At other times, their trust is in their own cleverness or their own ability to do things through politics or through military might and these kinds of things. And so keep in mind, this is a prophecy about Babylon, but is meant to be heard by Judah. Now, since this prophecy was given at a particular time and then included in this book, the first verse is his introduction, if you would. In other words, this was not necessarily a part of this prophecy. So I hope I'm not being too technical, but think about this. If he spoke this prophecy and then wrote it down, and then he took a collection of these prophecies and put them together so that Israel would and Judah would get the message, he's going to then have to interpret the philosophy of these prophecies and say, oh, this was the one about Babylon. And he puts that at the beginning of it. So verse 1 says, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. And the fact that his name is mentioned again tells us that this is a new section of the book. All right? Isaiah the son of Amoz had already been introduced in the first part of the book, chapters 1 and 2. But it's a new section of the book. And what he's saying is, there's all of these prophecies I'm going to relate to you. These were given to me. And here's the one about Babylon. So keep in mind, when the people first heard it, the first words they would have heard were, lift ye up a banner. When he actually spoke it to the people, they wouldn't have heard the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. Because they knew who Isaiah was. They would have known this who's saying it. They would have figured out by it that it was about Babylon. But what the first thing they would have heard was, lift ye up a banner. Now the reason that's important is as we go through it, we'll see that this is a prophecy. And one of the things that happens in these biblical prophecies, in the Old Testament especially, is we have sort of a mountain effect. If you ever go somewhere where there's large mountains, I've seen a few large mountain ranges. But if you stand on the ground and let's say you're miles away from the mountains, as you look out in the distance, you see the mountain range, right? And you see the various peaks. But as you look at those mountains, can you tell always the distance between the peaks? You can't. Right? You just know there's mountains out there. And it might look like one peak is close to another when they're actually miles and miles and miles apart. Because that distance flattens out the perspective, right? And in so many ways, the perspective of these prophecies is flattened out. And so what you're going to have is you have some of these prophecies that are fulfilled within years of them being spoken, and some of them have not yet been fulfilled. Because there's this flattening effect of looking into the future, if you would. And so when he starts this prophecy, he says, lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain, exalt the voice unto them, shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. And what do we see here? He begins this prophecy and he says, I've called a select group of people that's been called to come and do something. A noise of the multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of battle. Now, these are people who are doing God's will. And interestingly, throughout Isaiah's prophecy, he uses this concept of people who are doing God's will, but not knowingly. For example, Cyrus, the king of Persia, ends up doing God's will by allowing the Israelites, the people of Judah, to go back to the land and rebuild Jerusalem and resettle there. And God calls Cyrus in the book of Isaiah, my servant. But Cyrus, when he was doing that, had political reasons for it. He wasn't going, I'm serving the Lord. But what God is saying is he's doing his intention. It's much like the brothers of Joseph, right? The brothers of Joseph sell him into slavery. And Joseph's statement to them is, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. The intentionality of the brothers, in their choice, what they chose to do was to attempt to harm their brother. But God used that choice of theirs to conduct his own will and to rescue the nation by sending Joseph ahead of them to save many people alive. And in the same way, Cyrus was doing something that he thought was wise politically as an emperor in that day, but he was actually carrying out God's will. Unknowingly. but God calls him my servant. And that's the same context that's going on here. You have this great multitude of armies assembled, and they're doing God's bidding, but not knowingly. It's not as if this is an army of people out there that say, God has called us to do this. No, they may have their own political agenda for it. And as we get further into this, we're going to see that this is actually a prophecy of something that's in the future. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. Now, the vast majority of the times that this phrase, the day of the Lord, or the phrase in that day, is used in the Old Testament, the vast majority of the time that that's used, it is a reference to the end times. Okay? What we might refer to as the tribulation and millennium. That's how it's used. When it's blessing, it's usually what we would call the millennial kingdom. And when it's fighting, curses, plagues, it's the tribulation period. And we can line them up. Okay, but it's an end-timed judgment. So he says, howl ye. This is a very strong term. Howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It's the idea of wailing in pain and in sorrow. It shall come as the destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all the hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt. In other words, people are going to be terrified. They'll have no strength in them, and they shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them, and they shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. In other words, it'll be like birth pains. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. Now, what's that mean? Their faces shall be as flames. Their faces will be red, whether it's red in astonishment or whether it's red in pain. It's the metaphor of red-faced. Okay, their faces will be red from the excruciating judgment of God that has come on them. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light, and the sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And you say, well, how do you know this is actually an end times prophecy? Verse 10. Okay? Because that's never happened in history, where the stars stopped shining, the sun was darkened, and the moon didn't give its light. All right, that's never happened. The sun and moon darken, and the stars go out of the sky. That's not been experienced, right? That is an end times cataclysmic judgment. So what we see in this passage is, he's saying this is a judgment time coming from God that is in the end. It's in that day of the Lord. And I will punish the world. Look at the term he uses here. I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the gold wedge of Ophir, which was a region that was noted for its fine gold. What is he saying here? People are going to be dying so much that finding living human beings is like trying to find gold. Right? This is obviously a severe judgment. Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And it shall be as the chaste roe, and as a sheep that no man taketh up. They shall every man turn to his own people, and flee every one into his own land. Every one that is found shall be thrust through, and every one that is joined unto them shall fall by the sword. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled, and their wives ravished. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it. Now, again, this is a terrible, terrible prophecy. I mean, look at what he's saying here. The earth's going to be shaken. And then what is he saying here? There's going to be such judgment. There's going to be such destruction from this army that's described in the first part of this chapter that it's nightmarish. I mean, could you imagine anything worse than happening to you than imagine America being invaded by an foreign invader and there is no one to defend you. And in their invasion, they come and they beat your children to death before your eyes and rape your wives and burn down your houses. Could you imagine anything worse than that? Is there anything really worse than that? That's about as nightmarish as it could get, isn't it? I mean, to see everything you know about life and everything you love destroyed, ruined, and taken away before your eyes. That is the kind of judgment that he's talking about here. And he says, I will stir up the Medes against them. The Medes were a group of people that lived east of Babylon. Their bows also shall dash the young men to pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes shall not spare children. What does this say? Their bows shall dash the young men to pieces. It could be translated, with their bows they shall dash the young men to pieces. In other words, this army is going to come and is going to destroy the young men who would normally stand up and fight. Another possible translation would be this, and this is the one I would prefer, and that is, their bows and their young men shall be dashed to pieces. In other words, their military strength, represented by their bows and their young men, which is the source of your military might, will be dashed to pieces. In other words, there will be nothing to stand. Now, that is a prophecy and a very dire prophecy about the day of the Lord. That is the tribulation period. There is going to be a time in the tribulation period when God's judgment physically comes with the skies being darkened and when the earth is shaken. If you read the book of Revelation, you see these kinds of references. And you see wars and rumors of wars and these kinds of things, and just a massive war where massive amounts of the human population is killed and awful things take place. But what we see then is, remember, the people first hearing this didn't hear the term Babylon yet, right? Have you noticed the name Babylon hasn't occurred yet in the prophecy? It's there in verse 1 because that's Isaiah's introduction to it. But when he spoke it, he started with lift ye up a banner. So what does he do? He starts with a prophecy about what the day of the Lord will look like. Here's what the tribulation period is going to look like. And he says, and let me tell you about something that's also going to be like that. And now he comes back to a closer mountain top that's closer to their time. And this one is directly about Babylon. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms and the beauty of the Chaldees, excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures. And owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there. And the wild beasts of the island shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. So what does he say? You know what is coming in the day of the Lord? Well, similar to that, there is a judgment coming on the nation of Babylon. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, this beautiful kingdom, this glorious kingdom, and the beauty of the Chaldees, of the Chaldeans, excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. In other words, a time of judgment is coming on them that is like that coming day of the Lord and is also like God's past judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in. What he's saying is, it's going to be so thoroughly ruined. And we have two possibilities as far as when this takes place. It could be that it took place. There was a man whose name was Merodach-Baladan, household name, who was the king of Babylon. And he tried to get Hezekiah, who was king of Judah during the time of Isaiah's ministry. He tried to get him to ally with the Babylonians against the Assyrians. All right, to protect them against the Assyrians. But eventually the Assyrians turned and conquered Babylon and destroyed the city and flooded it. So it could be the destruction that took place in the days of Merodach-Baladan. However, then again, the kingdom of Babylon came to extreme power and became a world power under the rule many years later of Nebuchadnezzar. All right? So this is about 701 BC that the events are taking place in Isaiah's prophecy of the Assyrian invasion and all of these kind of things. That's right around 701 BC. However, Nebuchadnezzar comes to power and conquers Jerusalem in about 605 BC. So about 100 years later, a man named Nebuchadnezzar comes along and he reestablishes the kingdom of Babylon. But there is a day when his kingdom, not under his rule, but under the rule of his grandson, who we know from the scriptures, as Belshazzar, under the rule of Belshazzar, the kingdom of Babylon is conquered by the Medes and the Persians. And we have a reference to the Medes in this text. But what we also have to understand is that the Medes were also hired as mercenaries by the Assyrians to conquer Babylon in the days of Merodach-Baladan. So it could be either one of those. But here is the point theologically of it. And as I go through, we'll draw this out. But it is, God brings judgment at times on wicked nations. And there's going to be a time in the future when God is going to bring judgment on the world for their wickedness. In the past, God brought judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah, and there's a future time of judgment, but mark it down, there's a time of judgment coming on Babylon. You can't trust them. God's judgment is on them. Don't rely on them. That's not who to trust. That's not who to put your trust in. Now, when we had preached through the earlier chapters of Isaiah, we had seen chapter 7, where King Ahaz was putting his trust in the Assyrians to deliver him from the Syrian and Israelite invasion from the north. And God condemns him for that. And here God is warning the kingdom of Judah. It's not so much for Babylon to be worried about this judgment coming on. It's for Judah to know, don't become an ally with the Babylonians and think their solution to your problems. God is the one who has the answer. I mean, throughout the Old Testament, what does God say that the Israelites are to do and not to do? Why was it a sin for David to take a count of his men, to take a census? Why was that so bad? Because by doing so, he was trusting in the military might of the nation and forgetting that God fought their battles for them. Did he beat Goliath because he was a better warrior than Goliath? No. God delivered Goliath into his hand. And did he deliver the Israelites out of the hand of the Philistines because the Philistines were weaker than them militarily? No. God delivered the Philistines into their hand. And so counting up how big your army was for your own pride's sake was a sin because it was not trusting in God. That is why in the book of Deuteronomy it says, when you have a king is not to multiply to himself horses. Well, why would you have lots of horses? For your chariots. In other words, don't worry about a big standing army and lots of military preparedness because God will be the one who watches out for you. Now, keep that in mind. That's under a very specific covenant. If you keep these commandments of mine and follow this covenant, I will bless you. And if you break these, I'll bring curses on you and drive you out of your land. We're not under that covenant. And it's a mistake for us to claim that covenant. Okay? But nonetheless, there's still a parallel here of us trusting God. There are a lot of times that we are tempted to think things are in our hands. And we're tempted to worry. We sang, "O God, my joy." And in that second verse that Pastor Mauger pointed out, it says, "Through suffering that your love ordains." And there are many times that we're going through a trial and we forget that the Lord's using that to not just draw us to Him, but to cause us to trust in Him and to change us into what He would have us to be. That suffering is there for God to ordain, by His love, to ordain change in our life, to bring change in our life. And it's not always, I mean, really, when you sing that song, if you think about that text, you go, this is pretty hard. It's not easy words to sing, that God has ordained suffering in our life to bring change. I mean, that's exactly what James does, right? Count it all joy when you fall into various temptations, diverse temptations, or various trials, knowing that the trying of your faith worketh patience. That's not easy. But what happens is we want to try to find a solution. You know, we went through a little bit of a trial. Actually, it was a pretty big trial, at least in my mind, at the end of last year. When you're facing lawsuits and those kinds of things. And I'm not going to get into the details of all of the conflict, but just the idea that there was a trial there. And in the midst of that, there were a few times people said to me, "How are you doing, Pastor?" And I said, you know, and I wasn't saying this to be spiritual, but it was legitimately what the Lord was doing in my life. I said, the Lord is working in me. And am I worrying? Sometimes, yes. Am I fretting? Have I lost sleep over it? Yes. Absolutely. But on the other hand, there were times that I was actually singing that song in my own private worship, "Through suffering that your love ordains." That even if this is a hard trial, and, you know, to really compare it to what, you know, some of our brethren in Uzbekistan or something are going through, it's really kind of silly, but it was a trial nonetheless, and in it, you know, I was saying, you know what, Lord, you've put this in my life and the life of our church for a reason. And for nothing else, to teach us to trust you more, that this is in your hands, that there's nothing we can do to finagle this and fix this. But, you know, what it is that we want to get things under control. We get a little concerned when things don't feel like they're in our control, don't we? Right? When we go, you know, I really don't know how that's going to work. That is why some of the hardest trials are the ones that have to do with people. Because sometimes when it's circumstances, sometimes we can finagle things a little. Sometimes you can't, but sometimes you can go, well, if I move this money here and move this money here and do this, I can pay that bill and get that creditor off my back. Sometimes we can do that, right? And solve that problem right there. But you know what? When we have a loved one who's an unbeliever and we're giving them the gospel and we're just grieving and wanting them to be saved, that's one where we just say, well, I can't make them get saved, right? There's nothing I can do. It's not like moving bank accounts around or something. You know, it's not like, you know, well, what I can do is the car needs tires, but, you know, I can drive a few more thousand miles until I can save up the money to put, you know, I feel like I can handle that. But the thing is, when we have a child or a parent or an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent who's away from the Lord, we that's a stressful thing because we feel like it's out of our control. But take heed to the message that's here. What are you trusting? You know, the people of Judah were being tempted to say, let's trust in Babylon. They're another power that can rival Assyria and maybe rescue us. God is saying, no. This isn't in your control. It's not in Babylon's control and it's not in Assyria's control. It's in my control. Trust in me. Now, again, this doesn't mean that you be, you know, this is not a call to be irresponsible. This is a call to be recognizing the truth that God is watching out for you. All right? You don't fail to pay your mortgage and then say, well, I didn't know how God didn't provide when the money's in the bank, right? You just forgot to write the check. Well, then you pay, write the check. But the fact is that sometimes because we can write the check consistently for years, we think we've been the one providing the money when God's been the one providing the money. We think that because things went well for us in relationships for a long time, that it was our skill in relationships that caused that. And we forget that it was God's good gift in our life. And then when we do have a conflict, we think, what did I do wrong? How can I fix this? How can I use my skills to fix this? And we tend to want to trust in ourselves. And so God is calling on the people of Judah here to not put their trust in Babylon, because just as a judgment came on Sodom and Gomorrah, and just as there's a future tribulation period of great judgment, God is going to bring his judgment on the Babylonians. And so he gives a kind of a poetic, in verses 20 through 22, poetic description of what's going to happen there. In other words, it won't be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian, that's the Bedouin. He's not going to pitch his tent there. So this is going to be the kind of place that's spooky. All right? That's kind of spooky. When I was a teenager, I never went there, but I had some teenage friends that knew of an old insane asylum that had been closed down, and they knew how to sneak through the gates and get inside, and they'd go there on a Friday night, hang out. They'd take a flashlight and walk around, and you could see all the creepy, you know, rusty equipment. You'd see the tables where they used to do shock treatments on people and stuff. Weird things, you know, back from early 20th century. And you, teenagers used to like to do this. I'm not recommending it, teenagers, and it's not necessarily a wholesome activity. But they used to like to do this. Well, why would they go there? Because it's creepy, right? The windows are broken. It's dusty. It's just creepy. Things are rusty. And that's the kind of place where you think there's going to be ghosts. There's going to be bats. There's going to be bugs. There's going to be things like that. Right? That's the thinking. And that's the point. This is going to be a creepy ruins where even the Bedouin won't want to put his tent into nearby because he's going to be afraid of the ghosts that are there. Okay, that's the concept of it. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures. In other words, this can become a place for creatures to come and live. Years ago, I had the opportunity to be in South Texas, and in the area where my grandfather and great-grandfather were born, way down in Mission, Texas, way down by the point of the Rio Grande Valley there, and been in the area where they grew up. And I, before I went down, I asked my grandfather, I said, do you know where the house is that, you know, until you were a few years, you know, until you left Texas, the house is that you lived in with your parents? And he said, yes, I went down there once and went by to see it. He said, it's a chicken coop now. It had gotten old and run down, and the people who bought the property, it was a chicken coop. So it was a little house, it was a little tiny house, and it was a chicken coop now. And, you know, but 100 years ago, probably about 100 years ago, my great-grandfather was living in that house, farming grapefruit on that property, but today you go by, it's a chicken coop. Not the kind of place you'd probably want to spend the night. And here's the idea, that these creatures have come in owls, bats, those kinds of things. Wild beasts of the island shall cry in their desolate houses. And a lot of these references, like satyrs and dragons and things, are metaphors. All right? The idea is not literally that there are dragons that fly around. The idea is that, you know, these mythological creatures, like ghosts, are going to be there, and people are going to be afraid to go near it. It'll be uninhabited, okay? That's the idea. It's not really the idea that God is really saying these creatures exist, but mythologically, people will attribute those creatures to be living there, that the demons will be living there and those kinds of things. Now, do I believe that, you know, dinosaurs existed and those kind of things? Yes, and sometimes people want to read dinosaurs into every time you see dragon in the Bible, but I think it would be highly unlikely that in, you know, say, 700 BC that dinosaurs were living in Babylon. You know, maybe they were in Africa somewhere if they were still not completely extinct, but the fact that you'd have, you know, a T-Rex wandering around Babylon seems a little unlikely to me. just because, remember, that's pretty recently, okay? Now, I'm not discrediting the fact that dinosaurs were on the earth with human beings, especially before the flood, but I think in our zeal to want to prove creationism, sometimes we want to read into a passage. You got to kind of put into context what it is. You know, it had been an inhabited city. If there were dinosaurs still on the earth at that time, at that point, I mean, we're talking about thousands of years after the flood. If there were dinosaurs on the earth at that point, you're talking about in rare areas. They weren't walking down the street with people. You know, you didn't have walk down the street of Babylon. Oh, there went a Brachiosaurus. You know, they keep getting in the way. It just wasn't working that way. Okay. But what you do have is this prophecy, nonetheless, is saying destruction is coming on the kingdom of Babylon. And it's going to be so fully ruined that the only thing that's going to want to live there are ghosts and creepy critters. Right? Snakes and things of that nature. And so, do you really want to be putting your trust in them? Because not too long from now, their beautiful city will be nothing but a wasteland and a ruins where these creatures live. That's the first half of this prophecy. Chapter 14, which I'll preach on next week, is the second half of this prophecy. It's a little more complicated, but again, it continues this prophecy against Babylon. It's a very well-known passage because it just is well-known, and there's a lot of discussion about whether or not the king of Babylon is a reference to Satan in that passage, all right? Whether or not the king of Babylon in chapter 14 is Satan. We will cover that next week, but I want to draw our attention back to the point of these prophecies for Judah. Why is God telling Judah about the destruction of Babylon? He's not telling Babylon about the destruction of Babylon. He's telling Judah about the destruction of Babylon. And that is because he wants Judah to take heed that their trust should not be in their allies, but should be in the one true and living God. And that's what he's calling us to do even today. That's the same message for us today. Different context, different historical context, but the same message for us today. Our trust shouldn't be in our own ability to change things, but in the one true and living God who's watching out for us. Let's bow our heads.